This past Saturday on Elephant Talk, Julie and I interviewed John Gibler, an American journalist who has been living in Oaxaca and reporting on the situation down there. We'll talk to him next. You're listening to Elephant Talk on CHLY. And we're back. That was music from Kahil Elzebar's Ritual Trio, his brand new album called Big M. That was the title track. In May of 2006, a teacher's strike calling for higher wages led to the occupation of many buildings and streets in the capital city of the Mexican province of Oaxaca. On June the 14th, 2006, the Oaxaca Teachers Union was evicted. By October, supporters of the strike, which was led by the Asamblea Popular de los Pueblos de Oaxaca, had grown to tens of thousands, calling for Oaxaca Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz to resign. Demonstrators launched a widespread campaign of civil disobedience and took over the state-run TV station. However, the feds seemed to ignore the situation until, on October the 22nd, paramilitary forces fired on a crowd of protesters, killing three, Esteban Zurita and Emilio Alonso Fabian, two locals involved in the demonstrations, and Brad Will, an American journalist who had been videotaping the protest. Apparently, the death of an American in all of this crisis was what brought Mexican President Vicente Fox to order riot police to regain control of the city. We go now to our interview with John Gibler, an independent journalist working and reporting from Oaxaca. John, first of all, gives us a rundown of the situation to date.
Every year for the past 26 years, the local Section 22 of the National Union of Education Workers, which has long been one of the largest labor unions in Latin America, and in Mexico on the federal level, one of the most corrupt. But for the last 26 years, the Oaxaca local section has been a dissident faction inside this national union structure and carrying out a fierce battle to democratize the union and also to bring attention to the desperate state of education in Oaxaca, which is one of the poorest and most marginalized states in Mexico and also one of the most heavily indigenous. Over a million people in Oaxaca, about a little over a third of the population, who speak a non-Latin language, an indigenous pre-Hispanic language, as their first language. So every year, the teachers, for about 26 years, have carried out marches, protest encampments, major direct action protests in order to get a higher education budget, more schools built, roads built out to the schools in Oaxaca. This has literally been an annual affair in Oaxaca. But this year, when the teachers went on strike May 22nd, the governor of the state of Oaxaca, Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, who was elected under very dubious circumstances in 2004, refused to sit down in a dialogue session with the teachers, absolutely refused to engage with them in any way. And then finally, on June 14th, nearly a month later, at dawn, sent over 1,000 state riot police into the town center to violently lift their protest camp. There were police helicopters that fired tear gas from the air and riot cops on foot who stormed into the Zocalo, beating hundreds of people, destroying their radio station, which had been moved out into the Zocalo for the purposes of the protest, and not only wounding and repressing, but seriously and very deeply offending people, because this was the first time in 26 years when the governor had not even deigned to entertain a conversation with these people, but had simply and only responded with overwhelming violence. There had never been a repressive move against the teachers' union in it like that in its 26 history. Yes, there had been clashes with police, but usually in the daytime, and when the police would shout for 4 or 5 minutes that they were going to come in and give most people a chance to get up and run. On June 14th, there were women and children sleeping in the tents, elderly people, people with physical disabilities in these protest camps, most of whom were severely affected by the incredible amounts of tear gas and then also beaten as they were caught in their tents in the tear gas. This provoked an amazing response, not only from the teachers' union, but from everyday local citizens in Oaxaca City, who within hours spontaneously organized, took to the streets, and battled the cops. And on June 14th, and see, this was the first but not the only time, the protesters defeated the police. They stormed and surrounded the police, pelting them with rocks and with some Molotov cocktails, which are plastic soda bottles filled with gasoline and a rag. Excuse me, which when you throw it basically just sets a small fire, but of course if one lands on you and breaks, then it could cause serious burns. But they beat the police back, and since June 14th, they controlled the city center and unleashed an unprecedented civil disobedience, unarmed uprising in Oaxaca that has gone through several phases, and it's now 4 months history. The first phase was in preparation for the July 2nd elections. They mobilized what they called a punishment vote, or in Spanish, voto de castigo, where they went heavily into the grassroots communities organizing to vote, not specifically for the opposition candidate, but very much their campaign was voting against the ruling party and the party of Ulysses Reis, which is the institutional revolutionary party known for its Spanish initials as the PRI. They defeated the PRI in Oaxaca for the first time in over 75 years, the first time since the existence of the PRI. They lost the presidential election in Oaxaca, and bolstered by that show of their political organizing muscle, in late July, they initiated a campaign to paralyze the state government and thus force the Senate to effect a move in Mexico known as the disappearance of powers, so where the federal Senate steps in and says a state government is no longer able to function, and so it thus suspends the state government, moves a provisional government appointed by the Senate until new elections can be held and state government can be returned to power. So this became the central strategy of the protesters, who now were not just the 70,000 teachers in Oaxaca who are members of the local Section 22, but hundreds of thousands of people who had joined in from Oaxaca City and from across the state. In late June and early July, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, or the APO for its Spanish initials, held what they called mega marches, which are marches of 500,000 or more people in a metropolitan area of about 400,000 people. So they actually put more people on the streets in a march than lived in the city.
Whoa.
Of course, bringing people in from surrounding areas and from across the state, but an incredible show once again of A, the support for their movement, and B, their organizing abilities. Throughout then on late July, starting on July 26th, they unleashed their campaign to create ungovernability, they called it, in Oaxaca, and thus forced the Senate to exercise this disappearance of powers capability that they have. They surrounded the government offices of all three branches of the state government early in the morning with protest camps, making it impossible for workers to enter the building. They took over that way the state capitol, the governor's offices, the state congress, state courts, state attorney general's offices, and for months the government was not able to work inside its own offices. Ulysses Ruiz has always maintained that they never stopped working, but if they did continue to work, they did so from clandestine points across the city, such as hotels and office spaces that were unadvertised as now being rented by the state government.
Where is Ruiz at this point?
Ruiz has pretty much been underground since June 14th. He's moved from Mexico City to different luxury hotels in Oaxaca, and also he works out of a hangar at the Oaxaca City Airport, which is heavily guarded.
So that's the one place that they didn't take, that the people haven't taken, is the airport.
They discussed it, and they decided not to. They've taken over television stations, radio stations, government offices, but they never went out to the airport.
And they also, so they have control of the television, the state-run TV station.
Well, this is all leading up until the recent incursion of the Federal Preventive Police in Oaxaca.
Oh, right.
Last Friday, on October 27th, paramilitary shot three people dead in the streets, one of whom was the United States indie media journalist Brad Will. That affair, and particularly, I think, the assassination of the United States journalist, sparked the president, Vicente Fox, to, after months of mostly ignoring the conflict, send order in the militarized Federal Preventive Police Force to take control of the city.
Let's talk about the paramilitaries. Who are these people, and how do they show up? And
the paramilitaries are all members of the ruling party here, and have been identified as members of both local and state police forces dressed in civilian clothes. They've been acting since July. Initially, it was gunmen who arrived at different protests and would shoot into the air just to spark chaos and provoke confrontations between protesters and other local citizens. But amazingly, the Apple protesters, when the gunmen would come out and shoot into the air, they would rush them and they would take them prisoner. And then, even more amazingly, they didn't beat them and they didn't torture them, but they turned them over to the federal government. I was witness to those, to such apprehensions on several occasions in July.
Hmm.
But as the, gunmen shooting into the air was thwarted by the members of the protesters, soon the gunmen began to shoot into the crowds. On a march in early August, gunmen stationed in a house shot into a march as it was going by and killed one person.
Jeez.
Since then, there have been several paramilitary attacks, most of them focusing on the protesters' control of different radio stations, which they use to organize support mm-hmm. and organize responses to repression. And to give it an idea, they started out, these paramilitaries, as just individual civilian-clad police officers with pistols, but in late August, beginning on August 21st, a convoy of 40 cars and pickup trucks and minivans, some of which were official police vehicles, marked police vehicles, set out in Oaxaca City and went to the antennas of the state television and radio stations that had been controlled by the protesters for 21 days. They took them over on August 1st. They shot at the people who were there guarding the antennas. Several people were wounded. No one was killed. But all of the people guarding the stations fled. And the gunmen got out of their cars, went up to the radio and television equipment, and destroyed it with machine gun fire, shotgun fire, and shotgun fire. Since August 21st, the state public television and radio station has not been able to broadcast for that reason. The following day, the protesters, in retaliation, organized the takeover of 12 commercial radio stations in Oaxaca.
Wow.
There are 13 in the whole city, so they took over, let's call it 98% of the commercial radio space in Oaxaca City within a space of 9 hours. And this was a spontaneous reaction. People just organized, called each other on cell phones, found each other in the street, and crowds of anywhere from 500 to 1,000 showed up at each radio station, walked through the doors, didn't beat anybody, didn't torture anybody, told the employees that they were taking over. And that was that. That night, the convoy set out again. This time they shot at two newspaper photographers and then rushed one of the radio stations that had been controlled by the protesters, that had been taken over by the protesters, that had the strongest frequency and the longest reach across the state. This is a radio station known as La Ley, or The Law. And they shot at the protesters guarding that station and killed one person. That death squad, that convoy of gunmen, also about 40 pickup trucks and cars and minivans, was filmed by the national television station Televisa, which is pretty much the Mexican equivalent of the United States network Fox Network.
Hmm.
I'm not familiar enough with Canadian television to know what your right-wing station is. But,
we know Fox, though.
Yeah, you know Fox, sadly. Sadly, you know Fox. Well, imagine Fox television network showing local police officers driving through the city in a death squad shooting at people. Very, very damning, very powerful. You mm-hmm. can't go out and call Fox, you know, a left-wing conspiracy. And so as a result of, I really think, that television footage, and this is something I just wrote about for a New York City free newspaper called The Independent, which is also online, that as I think as a result of that television footage and the fact that they shot at newspaper photographers who worked for mainstream commercial national newspapers, the following day, the Secretary of the Interior in Mexico City called for a dialogue process. But it's important to step back and point out here that the paramilitaries have been shooting and killing people in the streets for months, and there's been no accountability. They've acted with total impunity, and the international press has largely closed their eyes or turned their backs to these happenings. There has been an Associated Press reporter on the scene here in Oaxaca, the Mexican, throughout this entire conflict, and she did not report on paramilitary killings. She misreported, in fact, on exchanges of fire. I've been present at these different events, and in none of these early July and August paramilitary attacks did the protesters possess or use any kind of guns or arms. So that was completely ignored or misreported in the international press. I was writing about this at the time for a website known as ZNet, also for a magazine that comes out of Chicago called In These Times. So the information was, in its very small way, getting out there. I was reporting for community radio stations in the United States. But the mainstream media did not pay any attention until months later the paramilitaries killed a United States citizen.
Going back to something you were talking about earlier, about the incredible coordination of people in the example of taking over the commercial radio stations, what in your mind can you attribute to this incredible coordination and solidarity amongst people?
I think at its deepest root, it's the fact that so many people support the movement. So many people are outraged at Ulysses Ruiz and what he signifies. And that becomes, I think, when I've done scores and scores of interviews with people and said, why did this protest movement explode now when Oaxaca has suffered from incredible repression in the past, brutal state repression, roundups of indigenous people, people being tortured, gunned down in the streets, accused of being members of guerrilla armed movements. Why now? And people time and again said it was because he offended us. They weren't even treated as human beings. It wasn't just that they got their heads cracked by riot cops on June 14th, but that it came from a man who, entering office, one of his main slogans was no more marches and no more protests. One of his first acts in office was to move the state or the governor's office and the state Congress out of the Capitol in two different directions, so that it would be impossible for people to carry out marches and protest camps easily near both branches of government. He, systematically refused to dialogue with protesters and also denigrated them, saying he said time and time again, for example, that the people who were protesting against him weren't even from Oaxaca. So he denied these people their own sense of belonging to their state and their region. You know, they would take to the streets saying that this wasn't fair, this was wrong, and he would say, you're not even from Oaxaca. So that sense, I think, of personal offense really fueled the outrage and the numbers of people. But, of course, it was built upon years and years and, in some cases, decades of poverty and marginalization and repression, and that extra element of, as they say, adding insult to injury, ignited the spark. I think that set off this incredible movement. But the organization, I mean, it is the fact that people are being amazingly brave, taking over radio stations, really raising the stakes of what we consider civil disobedience. But also very important that they've constructed a movement that is not built around a strong leadership structure. And there might be fallbacks to that as well, but one of the incredible advantages for them is that the decentralized kind of leadership or power in the movement allows for an incredible amount of flexibility and creativity. When the women who took over the state television station on August 1st had no authorization, they never held an assembly. They were all members of the Apple who had spontaneously organized a march to show that the women, as women, were also powerfully involved in this movement. They wanted to say, we're not just out here to brew coffee and make tamales for the men who, do the heavy lifting political work. We're also heavy lifters. And so they organized this march where they went through the streets banging on casserole pots and throwing eggs at the elite hotels that were rumored to be housing government meetings.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And then when they arrived in the town center, they just were so charged up. They said, well, let's go to the TV station and see if they'll let us say how we viewed this whole movement, because they never told the truth about what happened on June 14th. And thus people don't understand why we're so upset and why we're struggling for the ouster of the governor. So they marched. I saw several women in their 60s with casserole pots commandeer cars, like literally stop cars in the streets, tell most of the passengers to get out and the driver to take them to the television station. They go off to the TV station. They march right up to the door. The director comes out, and they say, give us 30 minutes to tell our version of what happened on June 14th.
Wow.
She said, no. They said, yes, this is where the Pueblo, you're a state, you're a public television station. You always say in your commercials that you're the station of everybody. We'll hear a lot of people. Let us say what we feel. The director said no, and they said, okay. And they walked right past her, thousands
wow.
of them. And they walked right in the doors, and they took over the TV station. And a few hours later, they broadcast live.
Which,
as far as I know, that's the first time that's ever happened in the Americas.
That's wow. excellent. Yeah.
But again, and then when I went later and interviewed, there's a provisional leadership structure that has been in place since June. It hasn't changed over, and there haven't been any new appointees or elections, because I think the movement's been in a pretty much constant state of crisis and threat. But there is a provisional leadership structure, and I went and interviewed mostly men, like probably 90% men on the provisional leadership structure. I asked them what they thought about the women's march and the fact that the women took over the TV station. Like, the coolest thing that had pretty much happened in the whole time is like, and the women did it. How did they feel? Everybody was like, I'm proud. I think that's amazing. They kicked butt.
Mm-hmm.
And that as well, to me, reflected the fact the movement was not cemented into leadership or centralized leadership or figureheads, which I think is also really enabled them to, like, that heavy emphasis on grassroots decentralized participation and creativity has kept people interested and kept people in the streets. One also little anecdote, slightly skipping ahead to the pitched battle in the streets this last Thursday, in a moment of relative calm, about 15 minutes in the middle of the battle, a bunch of people went back inside the university compound to sit down and rest. There were about five or six men sitting in the shadows, and one of whom has become the most famous of the provisional leaders. His name is Flavio Sosa. And a 23-year-old student who, isn't known from anybody. She's never been in the paper. She hasn't been on TV. She walked right up to him and yelled at him furiously to get up and get to work. This was no time to rest. And indeed, the women were all, preparing more Molotov cocktails and gathering rocks and shopping carts to wheel out to the front line and making improvised gas masks out of 2-liter plastic soda bottles with gauze soaked in vinegar. I mean, the women were like, as soon as there was a down moment, straight to work. And I saw this 23-year-old student just run up and, shout at the leader. And I just imagined, okay, if that was Napoleon, she'd had her, head cut off.
Wow.
But, in this movement, the guy laughed, realized that he just got, spotted by the teacher, so to speak, and got up and went to work.
Cool. Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to hear what you're saying about that. It's not like a particularly patriarchal movement, because that often still is an element in things that go on. That it still ends up being that men are seen as the central force in terms of what's happening? And perhaps, do you think that that's the central role of women as well is what's leading to this being so successful?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that men and women here are truly integrated in participation in the movement. It doesn't mean, I mean, Mexico is still a heavily machista, you know, society with, you know, endemic problems of sexism. But I think they're probably a lot, I mean, I'm not going to go so far as to say every man in the APO is an enlightened feminist. But the incredible support for equality of participation in the movement is definitely, I think, key to its success in pulling and continuing to pull more and more people into the streets. And I mean, you would see some division of labor. Like, there are a lot of women behind the front lines working, but I don't think that was ordered. Also, on that day, probably the most prominent voice of the entire movement was this woman known as La Doctora, the doctor, who was on the radio the whole day. But also on the front line, there were women, you know, from very kind of frail-looking university students to housewives in their 50s and 60s who are out throwing rocks, you know, and risking their lives.
Right.
So I absolutely think that women's participation has been essential to the success of the movement. If the men had tried to push the women out or move, like, I can imagine the leaders being upset with the women for taking over the station and trying to go and take it over themselves, I think that would have fractured, if not broken, the movement, because anytime you're out in the streets just looking at who's there sitting in the encampment, walking in the march, or throwing rocks, it's men and women.
So something else I'm wondering about is the future of what is going on in Oaxaca. And have you seen, or has there been any declarations of support from other countries, either in the world or especially in South America? Like, has Venezuela said anything? Or
interesting, you know, I haven't seen, nothing's come across my radar screen from Venezuela, but I haven't been focused last week on international, but I have seen there have been major protests in Argentina and Brazil, and there have been protests in several European countries. I think people took over the Mexican consulate in Barcelona. There have been major protests in New York City, in Chicago, and Los Angeles. So this has definitely become, you know, a major international event. I spoke with a friend in San Francisco who has been working on Latin American social movements and human rights issues for over a decade. And he said that on Thursdays he was listening to the radio on the internet and in constant communication with people around the country who were following the events in Oaxaca. He said they felt the earth move.
Wow.
So definitely I think there's an incredible amount of support. There's even been, I've noticed on some of the national commercial newspapers, there's been special photo galleries called, you know, International Support for the APO, where they show photographs from all the protests in Vienna and, you know, Brazil and United States.
And so moving on to what you see as the future of this movement, I know that a lot of exciting things happened in Argentina around 2001, and it's sort of been interesting to see how that's developed. And what do you see happening potentially in Oaxaca?
Two-part answer. One, I've been worried just personally, you know, kind of the, I don't know, some element of strategic thinking. When I first arrived in July, and I learned that their singular, non-negotiable demand was the exit of the governor, I was like, that's very dangerous. You know, you're risking a lot. And also, interestingly, to what I was just saying about the inclusion of women, I thought that's pretty macho. You know, I mean, you're really trying to say we're tougher than you. And I thought that's dangerous also because it's mostly a personalized demand versus a socialized political demand about, you know, institutional reform or, you know, addressing endemic corruption or marginalization in education or healthcare. So I've been worried about that singular focus on the governor, but that has been the backbone demand. They've never wavered in the slightest way. The press conference that was held by one of the Apple spokespeople only an hour ago here in Oaxaca City, they reiterated once again that they will not stop until the governor is forced from office or resigns. And there are even, I think the number is 11, there are over 10 people in Mexico City right now who are on a hunger strike who haven't eaten in over 20 days. Several people are becoming, you know, running serious risks of losing their lives in order to, in that manner, participate in pressuring for the governor's removal. And when we interviewed several of the hunger strikers, they were like, we're ready to go to the last consequences. We are ready to die, you know, to bring back from, you know, the Irish struggles of you know, the use of a hunger strike as a political tool. So, I mean, the conviction, the level of conviction is remarkable. It's amazing. And I don't think they will move from that demand. So that the first part answers to what is to come. Either the governor is going to get the boot and there's going to be a big party in Oaxaca City, or repression on a scale that I don't think anyone is even foreseeing in order to break the conviction that these people have. That's part one. Part two, the experience of participating in such an amazing and sustained and arduous civil disobedience protest, I think has changed the lives of everyone, or thousands who have maintained this participation here in Oaxaca, and has awoken, I think, a hunger and a way of envisioning how to satisfy that hunger for deeper change. So I've been concerned that the demand was too focused on the governor, but at the same time, I do think that even though that demand remains their single and non-negotiable demand, that they have begun to see beyond the day when Ulysses Ruiz steps down to deeper social changes that they want to push for in Oaxaca.
Well, thanks a lot for your perspective on the issues. Man, it's been really incredible, everything that you've been telling us about what's going on there, and very enlightening.
Where can you mentioned ZNet, and in these times, these are two places where people can, our listeners can follow what your reports.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anywhere else that you're publishing stuff right now online?
These days, I'm putting photos almost every day on Indie Media New York.
Okay.
And that's nyc.indiemedia.org.
Okay.
I've been doing writing for a Mexico-based English language newspaper called The Herald. But I pretty much daily cut those articles and put them on Indie Media as well. So that they can be available there. But as well, Left Turn Magazine, The Independent in New York, In These Times, ZNet, and as well, Democracy Now! Often calls and gets an update. And they put those transcripts online.
Well, that's fantastic, and thanks again. We have been speaking with John Gibler, independent journalist based right now in Oaxaca, and also human rights fellow with Global Exchange. Thanks very much again, John. We're going to go out with some music from Mexican band Los Rastrillos. This one's called No Hay Paz. And we'll be back next week.
Rastrillos y Dr. Mayal, compartiendo y resistiendo. Yes, I. No habrá paz si no hay justicia, Dr. Maya.
¡Bum!
Sigue, na, 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 voy, na. We sing again, we sing again. No hay justicia, no hay paz. Na, na, na.
Escucha bien, chucada.
Ya la gente no aguanta más. No. Está recuperando la dignidad. Igualdad para todos. Blancos, negros, amarillos y cafés. Diferentes entre la igualdad,
yeah.
Diferentes entre la igualdad. No olvidaremos a gente que ha luchado y dado su vida mejorando la de todos. No, no hay paz si no hay justicia.
no hay justicia. Solo queremos que haya igualdad. Lo que tenemos como democracia para nosotros es pura desgracia. No escuchan a la gente. Lo que piden nunca se atiende. Sabemos que no les interesa que la gente crezca y se fortalezca.
¡Resurja, mi gente!
Sabemos que no les interesa que la gente piense y cuestione esta dependencia.
¡Digo, mi gente!
Aprovechando el olvido, la apatía de la gente, confundiendo el camino donde podemos perder.
¡Sigue, mi mamá!
Recobrar lo perdido, replantear el camino, revisar su mismo para revolucionar.
¡Fire! Si el agua lava, el fuego desinfecta. So, escuchar rastrillos, yeah.
Que aquí todo va muy bien, cuando en realidad hay una guerra de baja intensidad. Son muy claras las estrategias, son muy claras sus intenciones. Mantenernos divididos sin poder organizarnos.
No lo lograrán.
Mantenernos divididos sin poder organizarnos. Sutil, sutil, de manera sutil. Para llegar a la mente no se puso un proyectil. Con la ignorancia manipulando, también están las drogas circulando. Tenemos a la iglesia que es como una anestesia. Mientras tanto los niños llorando, la esclavitud no habrá acabado. Mientras haya personas que sigan controlando. No hay paz si no hay justicia. Solo queremos vivir con dignidad, sí.
Y unidad, yeah.
Si no hay justicia, no dejaremos que nadie nos pise más, no. La gente que hoy seguimos en la lucha, debemos poner de la inteligencia mucha. Ni un minuto más de paciencia, que nuestro camino sea la coherencia. Necesitamos la fuerza de todos, como la tierra necesita sol. Necesitamos unos de otros, porque pelearnos entre nosotros. No caer en su juego, salir de la ignorancia, traspasar las barreras. Somos guerreros, musulmanes, judíos y rastafaris, indígenas y citadinos, marihuanos y guadalupanos. No olvidar a la gente que nos muestra el camino, asumiendo el destino y mejorando este lugar.
¡Ah! ¡Sí, la 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 la!
How's it going, eh?
I'm William Shatner, and this is Jimmy. Animals like Jimmy are often left behind by people fleeing hurricanes, fires, floods, and earthquakes. These abandoned animals cannot survive on their own. If you must evacuate your home, please never leave an animal behind. If you absolutely cannot take your animal with you, never leave him helplessly chained or caged. Many animals die because they cannot escape fires or rising waters. Animals need your help.